Was it?
David, a pleasure.
So they seem to like it over there. I mean, I don't think they had a no vote from either body.
So it's just one of the BOC.
Let's get it fixed.
Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order.
That's right, after hunting.
I want to thank members for their attendance at this interim meeting and the participation of our witnesses and public. It has been a year since Minnesota voted overwhelmingly to renew our investment in the outdoors and take a giant leap of faith to constitutionally dedicate more taxes to conservation in the face of the greatest economic decline in a century. Legacy Amendment now provides a dedicated conservation funding source for the next 25 years. Minnesotans and my own bias as sportsmen and women led this change for a decade, proving that the great outdoors is a heritage that binds all Minnesotans. With the passage of this amendment, this year also saw the passing of Norman Borlaug. This Minnesotan won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 for what was the Green Revolution of his time. Ironically, this green was about agricultural seed yields and occurred in India, the country from where my parents immigrated. I mention this because I find Mr. Borlaug's death symbolic. With our state's newfound energy towards the outdoors, and with Minnesota's history of doing big things, is it wise to ask if a new green revolution is needed, this time in regard to natural resource management? In my view, the success of the Legacy Amendment funding should raise as many new questions as answers if we are to keep faith with voters that the new money will be spent wisely. Any fundamental change must come from the people, as did the Legacy Amendment. And only Minnesotans can tell government whether true reform is in order. Now is the time for myself and others to open the door for such discussion. So what can we begin to question about our natural resources? A few questions come to mind. Are we spending new and old dollars for natural resources wisely? If we cannot give a satisfactory answer, Minnesotans may say a change is necessary. Does our money fund the mission or the institution? This may be a trickier answer than we suspect. Are state agencies meeting the needs of Minnesotans? How much of what we do should be for the long term? Should we use more natural resources for economic benefit or less? And should we rethink what we believe to be such benefits? These are just a few questions from one politician. I wager that this committee, and more importantly, the public, can ask better ones. Over the past few months, I've met with many stakeholder groups who have asked questions of their own and are interested in a new approach of honest self-reflection, free from personal agendas and bias. I heard important themes. Focus on the function before the form. Do not reform for reform's sake. We don't trust just one bill or idea. And most importantly, listen to us first, even our rivals. Discussions should review how natural resources are currently governed and develop strategic principles for Minnesota to implement reform efforts, but only if needed. We should consider partnerships between governmental entities, non-governmental entities, organizations, landowners, and others in the process. We also should consider modern science and find ways to simplify the system. The approach needs common sense and forward thinking. So today, while presidential posturing carries the news of the day, the Minnesota Senate Environment Committee will begin a sincere process with no bills on the agenda, where legislators listen to the ideas of Minnesotans on how government can better serve Minnesotans in the outdoors. We will need to be open-minded, shed our personal agendas, and just listen. It is our challenge as policymakers to help facilitate a ground-up process to examine our conservation functions. We must bring all new ideas together, reconcile them, and then act. It should be a joint effort from employees, farmers, businesses, local governments, environmentalists, and sportsmen to determine how we can improve natural resource management. Let's hear what people have been saying for a while and what people will say for the first time. Let's hear from the two people standing across the license counter from one another. I bet they both see some interesting things. And let's get out of St. Paul for a bit. As we trusted the people to pass the Legacy Amendment, so too, I think, can we trust everyday people to inject new energy into our mission. Only Minnesotans will do this if they desire, and not without problems, and maybe a long time, and our patience tried, just like the amendment. Maybe everything's fine, and we do nothing. Maybe some good ideas get defeated. Regardless, I've been informed by the office of the Minnesota Senate Majority Leader that the intent to initiate processes for reform or change or improvements this session, if just to begin the process, is dead serious. Some of us in government are ready to change, some of us are not. It will be difficult to distinguish between a bad idea and unwillingness to change. Do not think for a moment that government will change lightly. Our outdoor heritage truly defines Minnesota's quality of life. The Legacy Amendment was just the most recent of beginnings. Now we must work on effective and efficient government so future generations can carry on Minnesota's outdoor heritage. If just symbolically, could Norman Borlaug have passed away this year for a reason? Has the torch been passed to ignite yet another green revolution? I don't know. But one thing is certain, it will be Minnesotans once again that lead it. At this time, I open the floor to questions or comments from the members of the committee. If you have comments or suggestions or questions on the process from here on out.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not clear as to just what you mean by what the process is from here on out. I mean, in terms of activities of the committee?
Thank you, Sarah Olson.
Are you talking about the agenda for today, or?
The agenda for today, and what I want to make clear is that today is not the only hearing on this topic. We're going to have a series of hearings with the similar format, with the intent of developing a set of common themes and principles taken from the membership of this committee, and most importantly, stakeholder groups and Minnesotans, to see what functions we can improve in the natural resource management process.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. With that, and so we're going to begin this process by hearing from stakeholder groups that have done a lot of work on ideas for natural resource reform. And hear what people have been saying for some time and have been saying most recently. I'm also excited to hear from several former commissioners, and we'll be continuing this process in future hearings. We do have a hearing planned for January on January 15th in Bemidji. If folks have not gotten that saved to the date yet, I want hope that you can make it to that meeting and put that on your calendar.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry that already we have got overlap of committees, but there's a charter school committee. It's going to be starting here soon right across the hall, so if I am in and out, it's not that I haven't learned how to be two places at once, and I do need to be in that committee as well at times.
I appreciate you doing your best.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, and in no particular order, I'd like to introduce Dave Zentner, who will talk about the Conservation Legacy Council report from May 2007.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Zentner, and I live in Duluth and served on the Governor's Conservation Legacy Council. Our chair, ironically, Mr. Kilgore, our able chair, is in Duluth today. I don't know if I saw him on my way down the freeway as I came down, but I'm pleased to be here, and I'll stand in for Mike, do the best that I can, answer questions. I prepared an outline to try to get me through my comments fairly efficiently to hit some major themes. But I thought first it might be best to give you a little bit of background, maybe of what the charge the governor had in mind, how we were constituted, how long we existed, who we talked to, what the interface was. So let me begin rapidly with that. The charge from Governor Pawlenty, in the short description, was to make Minnesota the leading state in the nation in the governance wrapped around funding and governance of our state's natural resources. On his mind, the day that we launched, in particular, was concern about the fact that the existing arrangements might be overly duplicative, might not use dollars in the most efficient way, and he was particularly focused that morning on the complex of players that have to do with water issues, water projects, water regulation. Don't hold me to the exactitude here, but I think we counted at one time on a water project probably 16 government players that would be involved in such a project. Now, there were two members from the Senate, and not just because I'm in the presence of a Senate committee, or in particularly in presence of Senator Olson, but Senator Sachsag and Senator Olson, in the middle of a session, did a lot of gymnastics to make our meetings, not only to sit in on them, but to participate as well, and we all appreciate it. We had two members of the House, two members of the Senate, one from each party, 12 citizens appointed by the governor with a great diversity geographically and in terms of our lifetime experience and the things that we'd done both professionally and as volunteers. We had 10 meetings. We began working, I think it was on the 30th of November, 2006. We concluded on the 26th of April, 2007, and we met the deadline by the, having the report, which you all have in your presence, May 15th, 2007. The recommendations were reached on a broad perspective that basically shared the idea that hunting, fishing, outdoor recreation are important parts of Minnesota's heritage, and that creating a sustainable system for natural resource management is essential to Minnesota's quality of life. I might digress just really briefly and say that, remember, that was pre-dedicated funding time. We're on the cusp of that important chapter in history. One of the three major recommendations has to do with funding, but I come to this table this afternoon convinced that funding alone, will not get us to the vision that the governor talked about on the 30th of November, 2006. If we're to be the best, the hand in the glove is the funding and the governance delivery system working together. And I agree with the chair's comments, not only with his comments, but with his spirit of moving us to a bipartisan, serious, in-depth examination of the challenges of making the governance work better than we think it's working now. Three major recommendations were directed toward funding, a conservation, creating a Minnesota Conservation Commission, and creating a Minnesota Conservation Compact. I'm going to focus mostly on the second one. Before I go there, let me share with you our major conclusions. One, Minnesota's conservation efforts are inadequate. Conservation funding strategies fail to meet the challenge. Tax policy influences conservation and land use practices on private lands. Payments in lieu of taxes impact conservation and land use practices on public lands. Future conservation efforts must be based on sound science, and all Minnesotans must play a part. Existing conservation efforts are vastly complex. and unfocused. States. The states that we looked at use a variety of citizen-based governance models. Minnesota is almost unique, if not unique, in its underutilization of citizen commission. That may have changed a little bit with the creation of the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Commission and the Clean Water Council, but that was a very interesting finding. A citizen-based commission, the final recommendation, should set strategic policy and provide a direction and oversight. And I might also interrupt myself. Present in my lifetime of being a conservation volunteer, there have been the concerns that I've had in how often trying to clean our air, our waters, to have diversity within our wildlife community is a divider among us as a people instead of a unifier. In the most generic sense, almost any citizen we talked to outside the Capitol this afternoon would agree with those goals, but getting to them often divides us, and sometimes ideologically very broadly. And I think that the governance structure, with its complexity and its tendency to be top-down, is a servant in the division, often not in the unification. And we talked at length about the desire to regionalize, to flatten the structure, and to bring conservation to the people in more of a, and I hate to sound too idealistic, but in a partnership sense. It is easy to do a rant in greater Minnesota against a government agency. It becomes more difficult to do that rant when your neighbor participated and had ownership in the projects that you're talking about, whether it's at the PTA, at the church, or at some kind of a community meeting on a particular project. The key thrust from all of us, is accountability, securing outstanding leadership, stakeholder involvement in conservation policy, and conservation funding. I will repeat, this is a, to use a big word, in my opinion, a very propitious time in our history to launch these conversations. If this evolution of roles and responsibilities is apparent, then I think it begs the need to evaluate effective governance models. Let me talk a minute. If you want to turn to pages 6 and 7, I've laid them before me on the Conservation Legacy Report. And I will just read through what our synopsistic vision of the Conservation Commission was. And then we perhaps can talk after I close. The Council recommends a citizen-based conservation commission be established in law to lead the state's conservation efforts. The Council recommends the commission be composed of, and we spent a lot of time on the numbers, and compromised with 4-9. I think the majority of us, I don't want to misrepresent my fellow council members, we're leaning more toward closer to the 4 than to the 9. But it obviously was not unanimous. Members should serve at large. That was unanimous. Rather than be appointed to represent specific political affiliations or interest groups, consideration should be given to geographic representation, obviously. And the council recommends that the primary duties of the Conservation Commission are the following. Create a conservation compact and take that compact to the people of Minnesota. Particularly important roles of the commission are to allocate funds appropriated by the legislature for identifying and addressing the state and regional conservation priorities and periodically reporting to the people of Minnesota on progress. Strategic direction and oversight. It's really encouraging to me to see the kind of strategic work that the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage council is doing with the eye toward 25 years down the road, now 24, with respect to dedicated funding. This need, that type of effort needs to overlap all of our natural resource efforts and bring together not just the Clean Water Council, the Lassard SAMs, the LCCMR, but all of our units, and engage nonprofit, private players, as well as the federal government. Conservation policy. The council recommends, the Conservation Commission recommend to the governor new state conservation policies and programs needed, and review existing rules, laws, programs, funding, and needed changes. By the way, I skipped over a critical part under strategic direction above, and that is the council recommends that the commission recommend to our governor candidates to serve as DNR commissioner, as well as to advise the governor when, in the opinion of that commission, the commissioner should be removed from office. As one of its major functions, the commission would provide strategic direction to the DNR commissioner in implementing the agency's mission. Skip down to interagency coordination. It's obvious as to need, but in my lifetime, we still live in a time in 2009 where too often we have divisiveness over the uniform the man or woman brings to the meeting or the organization that he or she represents, and natural resources management and progress do not do well in that kind of an environment. Connecting citizen stakeholders to conservation. It is recommended that the commission periodically hold public listening sessions on conservation issues across Minnesota. It should also actively seek citizen perspectives in the development and implementation of state conservation policy and encourage local government organizations and individuals to implement sound conservation practices. Another digression from me. In my lifetime, since I was in the 20s and 30s, I've been involved in an awful lot of face-to-face conflict and combat, if you will, from the Boundary Waters to Voyageurs Park, wetlands issues, wild and scenic rivers issues. And one of the things I've learned is that very often people who I think are my opponents, if I treat them with respect, are far less an opponent and much more likely to give their ears to my message. And in many cases, I can cite, I won't do it this afternoon, examples where we made great progress and helped each other on areas where we didn't have fundamental philosophical differences. The point is this. Every person has a story, and they want someone to listen to their story. And it is so critical that we find ways around natural resources to bring people in the room to be heard fairly, courteously. That doesn't mean that we end the great debates. The great debates are a wonderful part of all. It's how we do the debates. It's how we lead the discussion. Let me try to wrap this up. Let me summarize our work effort. We began by hearing presentations from leaders of Minnesota agencies, and that's listed, the agencies listed are on page 16. The council then went to a number of other states and looked at different governance and delivery models as a way to stimulate thinking about our recommendations. We devoted one complete session to listening from the members of nonprofit conservation groups with their points of emphasis and to citizens who were not a part of the organized conservation environmental community. Then a number of us did interviews with people we knew had extensive experience, people that worked for the Department of Natural Resources, federal agencies, soil and water conservation districts, people that we knew had a keen and well thought out historical perspective. And there is an executive summary of those interviews. And then the vision statement finally, and I will not go through the vision statement, but I ask each of you on this committee to go to page 49 at some point in the days ahead and go through the vision statement, because I think it is a useful part of it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my comments. One other blurb before I really quit, and that is, I co-chaired with Representative Lauren Solberg and a group of, there were 15 of us, the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources. And I started down that trail wanting zero legislators on the LCCMR, what became the LCCMR, and all citizens, and we compromised. And I learned an awful lot in that process. In a good and productive and healthy relationship in Minnesota between our legislative elements and our citizens. But I do remain convinced on the 7th day of December, 2009, that we have a lot of capacity to utilize the great citizens of Minnesota in helping you all with your jobs without co-opting the fundamental responsibility you have as holders of election certificates. But there is a great opportunity to make your work easier, better, and very representative of the views of the citizens of our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zentner. Questions for Mr. Zentner?
Thanks again.
When you were developing your recommendations, what principles did you use to come up with the precisely what you proposed?
Well, if Mr. Chairman, my response would be the principles were to make Minnesota able to meet those three goals of increased funding, of making us the best of the 50 in the governance around our natural resources, and in establishing a compact with the citizens of Minnesota around conservation, and to do it all on a consensus-based approach among those of us on the council. And you'll notice that every person on the council is a signatory to the recommendations that went to Governor Plante.
How did you define what is best? Did everybody agree on what was best for our natural resources?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I can give you a really good response to that. I think, you know, it's clear that we didn't want government to change for change's sake. It's clear that we wanted to follow sound science. Sound science came up over and over again. And that we wanted to move Minnesota forward very, very significantly in funding. We felt that the funding condition in November 2006, totally unacceptable, would not allow us to meet our goals of cleaning our water and providing for wildlife, et cetera. And thirdly, that important element of bringing people into the conversation, bringing people, flattening, there was a compelling need to move conservation governance more in touch with the citizens of our state. That's about the best I can do 2+ years after. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
Just to amplify on that, I think the mission of the council wasn't to flesh out all of what we envisioned or would hope to have in terms of a compact with the people. And so I think that your question, I think, is more in tune of what is best. We weren't deciding all of that, but we were looking at the governance structure, the funding model, the opportunities at the time that we were dealing with this, as to what kind of structure could lead us to that in a most engaged way between the public and the legislature.
Very good. So. Senator Kielash.
I have a couple questions, and you said that you're looking to make Minnesota number one in governance. Where are we now in your opinion for states? Who's doing a better job? Where did you get your best ideas from as far as other states go?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, again, that's a difficult to respond. What I've found in the last 20 to 30 years, we're talking about fish and wildlife management, mm-hmm. for example, forestry management. A lot of my conversations with people around the nation as I travel points to Missouri.
Okay.
And Missouri very often is selected, and I'm sure if we lived in Columbus this afternoon, we know there are some problems in Missouri. But the rationale is that their dedicated funding, they're an initiative and referendum state, and they did a statewide initiative twice, long, long ago, to establish a nonpartisan commission. The exec of that commission is on the governor's cabinet in Missouri, but is not appointed by the governor. It's a small group of people, four people on that commission. It's one of the most highly sought after spots in the state of Missouri. The second reason Missouri comes up very often is in 1976, through again initiative and referendum, they got dedicated funding. And I am told by experts in the field, professionals and private citizens, that over those years, Missouri has been able to outcompete states like Minnesota for the best and brightest public servants to come to that state and to do parks, to do forestry, and to do wildlife. Having said that, I have no great bias on a particular model. It's a combination of the funding and the people that will make a state great. There's been a lot. Minnesota's a highly respected and well thought of state in terms of the excellence of our public servants. And in my lifetime, there are many of them that I've known that I've been very proud to call a friend. We're certainly not at the bottom of the barrel to respond to that. I think we're a highly regarded conservation environmental community. The key thing that was reflected in the dedicated funding vote was people in this state saw that we'd begun to fall from perhaps being the best and the brightest in the 60s and the 70s, and that we were losing that, and they didn't want to see that continue.
Thank you. Could I follow up with one of the things that, number one, it seems like you're adding a layer between the governor and the head of the DNR, and I'm not sure who selects those, who does the recommendations on based on your model. Is that the compact that would, or the compact is made up of four people? It's like who does the recommendations for the DNR? Is it just that group of four people or nine people on that compact?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the compact was a vision for this commission to take this vision of what we ought to be doing in Minnesota to the people. The Conservation Commission itself would be the citizens, as we've recommended, from 4 to 9, that would be appointed, that would take that compact to the people. So the compact is a description of a vision. And your point about the governance has been a bit of a problem for me, as I sat before a number of you insisting, praying for an Outdoor Heritage Council, and at the same time complaining about the complexity of Minnesota's government. I look in the mirror and say, Mr. Zentner, you're part of the problem. Because every time we do something, we create something new. And the best way I can wiggle off that one this afternoon is to say that we very directly indicate in our report that the Citizens Conservation Commission should do the strategic work to look at our model from watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, up through the state agencies to address duplication, too many agencies, if indeed that's a problem, and the coordination issue.
One more, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I think you're asking for a little more money in a time when we're definitely short on the budget. One of the dedicated funds from the legacy amendment is it's great. We've got good stuff going. My concern is that how do we create, you know, do the kinds of conservation projects that create jobs to help Minnesotans with that money rather than invest elsewhere. And so I'm looking at it in terms of what's the vision for, even in your vision statement, it says economic interests and that to help help those interests grow in the state. I think it's a great great thing to have in there. Just looking for a little more clarity in what your or the commission's vision of that is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that's an excellent observation. Remember, the report came in on May 15th, 2007. The Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment was far from certain. And I think that we agree that the dream here is that a good deal of this will help make over 25 years the application of the dedicated funding money be done in a most efficient manner. I also believe very sincerely that the kinds of things that we need to do with private landowners and on public lands and in restoring our waters to fishable and swimmable and working with our parks and trails system will produce very good job stimulus. And the kind of men and women that will come forward to lead us to do those things are very often a graduate degree and beyond program who command very good wages. So I think it has an excellent stimulus opportunity.
Thank you.
Senator Dill, did you have your hand up?
Well, I did, and I think it was kind of answered, but Mr. Zentner, I think I heard you say that some years ago, 3 years ago or so, you didn't like legislators on the LCMR.
You did.
And I think what you were leading up to was saying that you changed your mind and now you think it's okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
But I didn't hear you actually say that.
It was Lauren and I had, Senator Dill, Representative Solberg and I had some real strong conversations with each other about it. And we did compromise. And in the process, I will agree that you heard me correctly. There's not only a good opportunity to use citizens wisely, but to keep legislators involved so that the educational process that is so critical to outside input that we have informed and committed people in the legislature. So there's some real partnership opportunities. Having said that, I am still disappointed to see the reluctance often in our elected members of the House and Senate in sometimes getting out of the way and letting the men and women in this state that have taken care of universities and hospitals and done great things in the private sector not do similar good things for our state in natural resources while the House and the Senate hold the bottom responsibilities, just like a board of trustees, a board of directors are accountable for the mission, the overall mission. So that's a real verbose answer. So it's yes, but I think we can do even more. You know, I served on a Minnesota Pollution Control Agency from 1974 to 79. Exciting days, Clean Water Act, all kinds of beginnings. And we made the decisions on policy. And I would say that gang did a pretty darn good job. Self-serving, but it's true.
Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Zentner, one of the reasons for the fact that legislators are on there is because only the legislature can appropriate the dollars to provide.
Right.
It's by statutory, definitely, and intentionally, because that is a specialized fund coming out of the lottery that's dedicated for it. And citizens just can't walk in and take it or decide to take it. It has to be a legislative body.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Hi.
Other questions?
You brought donuts today.
Thank you, Mr. Zentner.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone on the committee, and keep that spirit of working together up. This is a great opportunity.
Emily Franklin and Ron Nargang. This
Minnesota Environmental Initiative Land and Water Policy Report. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Emily Franklin. I'm a project manager with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative.
And Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Ron Narging with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you today. I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about our land and water policy project, which is a project our organization has been working on for about 2.5 years. But first, I'll start with just a little bit of background about MEI.
Ms. Franklin, we may need you to slide to your right or move the projector to your left a little bit.
Is that better?
Great, thank you.
Okay. The Minnesota Environmental Initiative is a local environmental nonprofit here in the Twin Cities. We're a little bit different from some of the other organizations that are out there. We're not an advocacy organization, and the mission of our organization is to solve environmental problems by working in partnership with business, government, and other nonprofits. So that's just a little bit about MEI. Our land and water policy project started really in the summer of 2006. We got some initial funding from the Department of Natural Resources to explore the interface between land and water policies and how they're implemented in Minnesota. There were three components to our project, an initial research or information gathering phase, the stakeholder process and the recommendations that came out of that, which I'll talk about in a minute, and an outreach component, which was really sort of integrated throughout the entire duration of the project. This project was also supported by the McKnight Foundation and Northern Environmental Support Trust. So just to back up to the fall of 2007 when we first started working on these issues, again, we wanted to look at that land and water policy interface and sort of do some exploration about what was happening at the local level in terms of implementing land and water policies. So we started out by having a series of focus group discussions in 5 communities across the metro area. These discussions were facilitated by Mark Huguenin with Pepin Huguenin and Associates. He's a former Met Council member and is very familiar with land use issues and active in Washington County. Interestingly enough, even though we had 5 of these discussions in various geographical areas with very different natural resource land cover, there were sort of 3 major themes that came out of the discussions that we had. The first one is probably not a surprise, and we've heard a little bit about this already. Our land and water governance structure in Minnesota is extremely complicated. Various levels of government have jurisdiction over the resources, and one of the things that was attached to that in the comments that we heard was that local units of government, particularly cities, spend a vast majority of their time working on plans. So things like the comprehensive land use plan, surface water management plans, stormwater pollution prevention plans in communities where that's applicable. And it sort of prohibits action around implementation activities. So that was the first theme. The second theme was that cities have the opportunity to be in the lead and should be in the lead in terms of protecting natural resources. Cities like that local land use control that they have. But at the same time, one of the things that we heard, which was sort of interesting, was that there really was a need expressed for a shared vision for natural resources among all actors. And finally, there was a strong focus on water. No matter how many times we wanted to talk to our focus group participants, which were members of local units of government, some elected officials, watershed districts, and even some builders and developers, we heard about water over and over again, even though we continued to ask about land. There were five recommendations that came out of our process, and just to clarify, these were recommendations that Mark Huguenin made to our organization, MEI, based on what we heard in the focus group discussions. And I'm not going to go through them in a ton of detail because really this scope of work was what led to our organization to design and facilitate a stakeholder process. So from here, when we completed our focus group work, we realized fairly quickly that there was a lot of other work happening on this land and water policy interface. And rather than start from scratch, we thought we would utilize some of these other scopes of work, some of which were considerable, to continue the conversation on this land and water policy interface. So we worked with a group of five individuals, which you should have a list in front of you of all of the individuals that participated in our stakeholder process. The individuals that have an asterisk next to their name were our core team, and they helped us not only select the report that you see in front of you on this screen, but also helped us to pull together our stakeholder working group. So that's just a little bit about the core team. And they really worked in an advisory capacity for us as we were getting the stakeholder process put together. They helped us set agendas for work group meetings and advised us throughout the process. Again, I'll just mention that these individuals, while they were extremely important to the success of our project and dedicated a ton of time, they were advisory. So that's just a little bit of background about how we got the stakeholder working group pulled together. We wanted to bring a group of individuals from, again, government, business, and nonprofit to talk about all of this work that had been done, to take a look at all of the recommendations that were coming out of various reports to see if there were common themes and to see if there were gaps and to identify some priorities. So we pulled together a group of 20 individuals, again, on that list that you have in front of you. And they were charged with the collaborative evaluation of all of the recommendations from those five reports plus our MEI focus group report. When everything was said and done, there were over 200 recommendations that were compiled. And I didn't make copies for everybody, but this is just the first page of a multi-page spreadsheet with all of the recommendations that we compiled. As a staff, we spent some time sort of synthesizing that information in order to prepare it for our work group members so that they could take that information and start to make some sense out of it. So that spreadsheet with all of the information from all of those reports is on our website if you're interested in it. A couple of other logistical things about how our stakeholder process worked. The group met from January of 2009 to July of this year, and work group members elected to form a series of subgroups to work outside of stakeholder meetings in order to bring information to feed into the conversation. And we also utilized technical advisors. We had a handful of individuals from local units of government come in to stakeholder meetings to talk about challenges and opportunities that they faced in terms of protecting land and water resources on the ground. And these individuals, again, were just providing information for the context of the discussion and didn't have a standing in terms of the decisions that were made. So over the period of about 6 months, our stakeholder working group identified three areas of focus that came, again, out of those 200 or so recommendations. These were the areas that were identified as high priorities and with some opportunity for the state agencies and other stakeholders to work together and move forward. The first one deals with shared vision. The second deals with coordinated management, and this is addressing sort of the planning gridlock that I referenced earlier that local units of government face. And the last one is integrated community assistance, and this deals with the services that state agencies deliver to the local level in terms of resource protection. So just a little bit of background on each of these. The need for the shared vision came from really the realization, again, that land and water policies are very compartmentalized in Minnesota, lots of entities with a stake. Each state and regional agency really relies on their own individual mission or vision, which is based in statute to go about their business. We spent some time in the stakeholder working group actually reading through each of the individual visions and or missions from the state agencies to determine where there was commonality. And really that this shared vision for land and water resources is needed to allow everybody to move together collectively. And so the specific recommendations related to this shared vision were really to draft a shared vision that spoke to outcomes for land and water resources, interagency coordination, and that the process would start sort of at the highest level with the state agencies developing that shared vision and soliciting input from citizens and other organizations to build that vision collectively. The next priority focus area or the need that really supported the working group focusing on this deals with coordinated management. And the slide that you see in front of you is an actual real-world example from the city of Blaine. Doug Thomas, who's with the Rice Creek Watershed District, helped develop this. And what you'll notice is from really now until 2013, the city of Blaine is in some sort of plan. They're either drafting a plan or amending a plan, which really, you can notice, doesn't allow for a whole lot of time for on-the-ground implementation activities. And so the recommendations to address this issue for coordinated management really just deal with improving the alignment of all of those plan dates. And the group was very cognizant of the fact that the metro area faces much different planning challenges than Greater Minnesota, especially in terms of water. So you'll see in a slide in a moment how the process for sort of improving this alignment would take place over the period of several years. And then finally, integrated community assistance. This really kind of ugly diagram that you see in front of you was developed by Barb Huberty, who is one of our stakeholders. She's with the city of Rochester. And she developed this in partnership with another gentleman with the city of Prior Lake, and it really just demonstrates how the natural resource staff at a local level are faced with all kinds of information from state and federal levels of government, and that in some cases there's not consistency or there's overlap and redundancy in terms of some of the information that's delivered to that local level, and that because these land and water issues are so complicated, that interface between the state and local level, and the partnership and the relationships that are built between the city staff and the agency staff is extremely important. So the recommendations that came out of the integrated community assistance priority focus area really dealt with sort of improving those lines of communication between the various levels of government. It was a fairly formal structure that was proposed with teams in an individual state agency working together on integrated community assistance with a larger working group comprised of individuals from various state agencies to work together on these issues. And then the third tier is really a large stakeholder group, if you want to think about it that way, with input from associations, other nonprofits, to be able to improve the delivery of technical resources to the local level. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Ron, who's going to talk about this last slide that really shows how the recommendations relate to one another, and I'll also have him touch a little bit on the reactions that we got from state agency leadership at our final meeting in July. We did present all of these recommendations to a group of about 50 individuals with commissioner, assistant commissioner, and division director level staff from each of the state agencies that participated in our process this past July.
Mr. Chairman, members, Emily has done a really good job of describing this, and I don't need to add a lot to it, but my role in the process was to facilitate these meetings and to chair the work group. And anytime we launch one of these stakeholder processes, it's really difficult to predict what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, where they're going to end up in terms of an outcome. And I spent enough years in state government to know that there's often a criticism out there that government can't do anything without creating a new program that costs big money. And I guess the point that I would like to make here is that if you look at these very basic recommendations, I was terribly impressed with this group in that they stayed very, very grounded in the message that came out of those focus groups, the message we heard from local units of government about the concerns about confusion and complication at the state level. I never got any sense from those folks that they were pushing back, that they were reacting negatively to those criticisms. Rather, they went right to work to say, all right, we've got a problem. These people clearly are feeling it, and the question becomes, what are we going to do about it? The first one, the shared vision thing, I thought was a wonderful thing to come out of the process. It sounds simple. It may be the most difficult task of the three on this chart because I think it means that state government, at its most basic, has to provide a vision that both the Department of Commerce and the Department of Natural Resources can embrace about what you're going to do about land and water management. And that's not going to be an easy task. It's going to be a challenging thing, and it's going to take some time. And these recommendations embrace the fact that the public has got to have a shot at this. They've got to understand what's going on and have to have an opportunity for input. If you look at the other two, the issue of alignment on planning, you're going to have to be engaged in this. And the proposal here very specifically would take an example from the metropolitan area where Emily has identified, I think everybody agreed that the confusion, the complications are magnified beyond what they are in the outstate portions of Minnesota, and would do a desktop exercise first to figure out if we could tweak the planning requirements of the agencies themselves and those requirements in statute to make these things align, to streamline them, get them on some kind of a consistent timetable so that we don't have local units of government in this planning gridlock continuously where they're staring at a half a decade or a decade of planning and everybody kind of wondering when they get a chance to catch their breath and actually implement what's in those plans. So the idea was to start in the metro area, run a desktop or tabletop exercise, learn from that, and then they're going to have to engage you in the kind of changes in statute that are required to actually line up those planning requirements because many times they get built right into the statutorial language and they're on some kind of a recurring time frame built into statute. And finally, the last one there would require a lot of commitment by agencies, but it can clearly be done internally. Overall, I would point out that they did not come up with something here that takes $5 million to implement. This is all very achievable, and it's achievable within existing budgets and with existing staff with a redirection or reprioritization of efforts. And given the kind of criticisms that actually launched this process, I thought it was a really commendable effort for them to come back and say, yeah, we think we could do something about this, and we don't need a new pool of funds to actually accomplish that. When we presented it to leadership, I thought it was unfortunate that it came about 10 days after the governor's announcement that he did not intend to run, because the commissioners actually reacted very positively to this, but you could feel in the room this tension about, I don't know for sure what this means to me, given the fact that we're going to have an inevitable change in administration coming up. And frankly, the people that were at the table, those leadership folks, don't know what their role is going to be in the ongoing direction of those agents. So I think they recognized the opportunity, and they handed this thing off to the EQB as a point where they could look to for some coordination across agency lines, and you're going to hear from that organization next so they can tell you what the follow-on steps have been that have been taken since we completed our work. And I don't think I need to add anything else to this. where we're at.
What were the common themes and principles of that you heard from your stakeholder process in coming up with the recommendations?
Well, you want to take a shot there?
I think I can speak to a couple of things that came up. One of the things that the state agency staff in particular were very cognizant of was that resources are limited. And I'll echo what Ron said, that these recommendations aren't going to cost a ton of money and really will just mean a realignment of staff commitments within the agency. So that's one thing that I think came up quite consistently.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the other thing is this planning thing. I mean, we literally heard the term planning gridlock used repeatedly by those people that are caught up in planning gridlock. And they just kept coming back to it saying, we can't get out of planning mode and get into the doing mode, and we've got to have some relief in order to be able to do that. So that was probably the most common theme we heard out of this whole thing.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nargang, what do you mean by you got to get out of the planning and into doing something, and you need some help to do that? What kind of help do you need?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, if you go back and look at the statutes on many of these planning requirements, the statute is very prescriptive on the kind of planning interval that it needs to be revisited every 3 years or every 5 years or whatever. It will also point out the size of communities that need to be engaged in the planning efforts. We have at least two stormwater planning initiatives on the table that are grounded in statute that have very different timetables assigned to them. They're managed by different agencies, and they end up just kind of following one on the end of the other one, and that gets compounded then by requirements for comprehensive municipal planning that's done on a recurring basis. You actually have built into statutes deadlines and planning intervals that are going to need to be tweaked in order to line these things up. And I don't think any of us have an answer for you today about what is involved in that. I think the agencies need a chance to get into this tabletop exercise and actually experiment with it to say, okay, how could we realign these things to make this work a lot better for local government? And frankly, it'll work better for state government too, because there's an awful lot of duplicative effort going on out there for all these multiple planning exercises.
Follow up.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I understand what Mr. Nargang is talking about now, and I agree with him. We need some adjustments. The one sentence that really captured my attention in this whole handout is on page 2 in the upper left-hand box, and it says, "Wetlands are king." We agonize about wetlands without looking at the other resources. We need a more holistic view. And as a co-author of the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act, and Mr. Nargang was working for the DNR at the time, it was a struggle, and we did a great deal to protect wetlands, but I always wondered about the hills in between. We need to worry about them and the oak forests, and there's so many other resources out there that need attention. I'm interested in farmland preservation, open space preservation, and it's... There's just a lot of things that need to be done besides put so many resources into wetlands.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, okay. You would remember my role in the Wetland Conservation Act. I'm surprised you didn't pick up on the other quote in there about the community that was so focused on wetland mitigation that they dug up a hardwood forest in order to mitigate for the loss of a wetland. You know, there's some of that that goes on, and those are very candid statements about the need to balance the competing natural resource issues. So I think the point you raise is a valid one, Senator Dill.
Other questions for the witnesses? What were some of your recommendations that came out of the report?
Mr. Chair, the recommendation, actually, after the meeting that we had this past July, the recommendation was made to essentially move the discussion on each of these three sets of policy focuses and recommendations into the authority of the Environmental Quality Board. And since that meeting in July, the EQB has taken up that responsibility and is continuing to work with some of the stakeholders that were on our process and new stakeholders to continue to move these ideas forward. I do have a couple of copies of the full report, which is also available on our website. One of the things that you'll notice as you actually read through the recommendations is that they are fairly prescriptive in terms of identifying state agencies or other stakeholders that should be involved in the steps that are being proposed out of our process.
Like, what are some of those?
Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Department of Natural Resources, engaging other stakeholders that weren't immediately part of our process, groups like the Citizens League, League of Minnesota Cities, and other associations of Minnesota counties, to sort of widen the net of individuals who have a stake in these issues to get them involved.
Mayor Kielash?
Yes, Ms. Franklin, are you looking at cross-agency employees or someone that bridges the gap between them all that keeps the plan moving?
Yeah.
Ms. Franklin?
Yes, Senator, Mr. Chair. They differ a little bit depending on which set of recommendations. The recommendations that dealt with integrated community assistance were very prescriptive in terms of having individuals from each of the state agencies dedicated to working on delivering services to local units of government. With the recommendations related to coordinated planning, it's similar. The group recommended forming essentially a smaller work group of state agency staff to continue to work on the alignment issues and determining the planning schedules and what would have to happen in the tabletop exercises. And I'm sure our colleagues at the Environmental Quality Board will have much more detail about what's happened since the meeting in July and what's going on with each of these recommendations going forward.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for your presentation and hard work.
Thank you.
Is Environmental Quality Board.
Yes, that was my cue.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Patton. I'm Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board, and I am a relatively new Executive Director in this position. I've been there 5 months. I'm on loan from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I was also a participant in the land and water stakeholder process. And one thing I want to say is that it was a very, very good process. It was very well run, very well facilitated. And so really hats off to MEI, to Mr. Franklin, and Ms. Franklin, Mr. Nargang, and Ellen Gibson, who was the other staff person on the project. They really did a bang-up job. I'm going to pick up where Mr. Nargang and Ms. Franklin left off, which is where they hosted a July meeting with state agency leadership, mostly commissioners of the environmental agencies, to talk about where these recommendations go from the stakeholder process. And the decision at that meeting, as was covered, was that the process would move on to the Environmental Quality Board for implementation. I wanted to address why the Environmental Quality Board was chosen for that. And the reason is really simply that the EQB has representation from all the environmental agencies that really would be involved. It also has five citizen members, so it has a citizen perspective as well. And among the core missions of the Environmental Quality Board is the coordination of state environmental programs. So these projects really seemed like a good fit to the mission of the Environmental Quality Board. As the MEI covered, there were three recommendations that came out of the land and water process: shared vision, coordinated management, and integrated community assistance. The EQB is presently working on two of those recommendations, the coordinated management and the integrated community assistance recommendations, and those are what I'm going to be covering today. The shared vision recommendation we maybe get back to later, but I think Mr. Nargang put it well, that it seems like a simple matter, but is not as simple. And in discussions with the agencies and Environmental Quality Board members, it seemed apparent that these two recommendations had a clear and convincing need associated with them, and were of manageable scope. And so we're proceeding on these two first.
What are some of the different visions that members shared or did not share?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Differences in visions.
Thank you for your question. I was not part of the work group, and so I don't know in detail all the missions that were examined. I know they looked at the mission statements of the various agencies. One of the key mission statements that the work group looked at was actually the Environmental Policy Act. If you look at 116D, the Environmental Policy Act, you'll see a very eloquent mission statement, if you will, for the state in terms of environmental policy. There's a very eloquent statement about environmental policy that probably all of us should read from time to time. So there are various essentially mission statements out there or vision statements out there for state government already. I hope that answered your question.
In general, what were some of the differences? Do you mean that Department of Health had a somewhat different vision than Department of Agriculture or Transportation? And in general, how did they differ?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I hope, I'm a little out of my league in terms of I did not personally study all those mission statements. So some of this is a little bit speculative, but I'm familiar with the mission of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, which I can't state verbatim, but it deals with food safety, it deals with the environment and the economy, essentially. So it's looking, it's almost, if you will, a sustainable development mission.
Okay.
I think you'll find those types of missions, those will be somewhat common elements, especially with the agencies that directly involve environmental issues. Other mission statements of agencies that are relevant to the environment but maybe don't have the environment as a core mission will be more focused, for example, on the Department of Health will be more focused on public health but also have an environmental health part of their mission. And, of course, mission and vision is different. So whether we have statewide vision statements is really another question. And there are various vision statements that are out there that again, I could not speak to because I haven't studied them in detail.
Okay. Maybe that'd be something interesting to bring up later on sometime.
Certainly.
We need to get at what's dividing us. Sometimes it's complicated, sometimes not so much.
Yes, and I think although the EQB is not pursuing the shared vision project at this time, I think everybody realizes that working on a shared vision would have some long-term benefits.
Okay, please but continue. Sorry to interrupt.
Not a problem, Mr. Chair. For the work we do plan to do, we are taking an approach of teams that have been built. On the coordinated planning project, a team has been put together. The actual full group hasn't met yet. There's a leadership group. A small leadership group has met through the fall, and their first meeting is coming up of the larger group. The team is being led by Lisa Thorvig of the Pollution Control Agency and Julie Blackburn of the MPCA, and then Princesa Van Buren Hansen from our staff, who's here today, is staffing that effort. And as you can see, I didn't put all the names down because it's really a long list of people that we're involving in that project. So that's the coordinated management team. The integrated community assistance team, the leader really at this point is Sharon Pfeiffer, mainly because she's done so much work at the DNR in this area. She's worked on a project called a community conservation assistance in the central region that is trying to integrate functions of assistance to local governments in that area. So she's been a real dynamic part of this group. John Wells of our staff, who is also here today, is staffing this group and really kind of chairing the meetings. And you can see the membership there. The membership of this group right now is very similar to the membership of the sub-team that worked on the land and water project, but gradually the group is going to widen to include other folks that aren't involved presently.
So the upshot is that the land and water policy project that MEI was working on has morphed and been adopted by the EQB.
Yes.
And is expanding its activities. And
yes, and I'll get into
seems
a
like
little
a good thing.
I'll get well, into a little bit more detail, Mr. Chair, on what some of those activities are. Yeah. I wanted to back up to the need a little bit and go back to a couple of the things that were covered in the MEI presentation. One of the things that I wanted to point out is there's a common thread between these two projects, and that common thread really is local government, local implementation. One of the things that we heard over and over again in the stakeholder process is that whether the policies are originating at the local level, at the state level, or at the federal level, oftentimes it's the local entities, the soil and water conservation districts, watershed management organizations, or general purpose governments that are implementing those policies. And in the process, sometimes our ability to give rational direction to local governments or to provide good information hampers their, it's not perfect, and their ability to carry out the work that we hope done is sometimes hampered. The coordinated planning, this is just the recommendation that came out of the MEI process to align planning schedules between state agencies to create efficiencies in the process. And here's the illustration that you saw before from the MEI report. Again, this was a real-life example from the city of Blaine showing the planning mandates that it faces over a number of years. Here's just the last 4 years, and I put these in terms of the lengths of these planning processes. Now, this isn't probably exact, but it's just to be illustrative of what happens with these planning requirements. The local government is faced with doing a surface water protection plan and a local water protection plan, a comprehensive plan, and a wellhead protection plan within this four-year space of time. And, of course, these planning processes take a period of time. And so, as you can see, they're really involved in continual planning processes over this period of 4 years. So there are a couple impacts of that. One is that that reduces the amount of time available to be able to implement programs, and their resources are being diverted to doing these plans. And I should point out that this isn't an indictment of the planning processes themselves, but just the timing of the planning processes, and which are usually in statute. The other impact is you can imagine that there might be a degree of lack of consistency among these plans, given that they're being done at different points in time, and that aligning the schedules somehow would perhaps help in not only being more efficient with local government's time, but also help with coordinating and regaining consistency among the various planning processes, and perhaps consolidating some of those planning processes. So those are some of the ideas. But of course, the devil's in the details. For example, how really do you align those planning schedules, and what are perhaps unintended consequences of aligning those planning schedules? What are the unintended consequences of the transition from one planning schedule to another? And then, what are the various statutes and rules that might be affected? And so this suggests that we need to think it through. And Mr. Nargang mentioned the tabletop exercise of really, and this is going to be in the metro area, of working through a real-life example on paper, essentially, of aligning what aligned planning schedules would mean, and then looking at the unintended consequences and how it really works. Once that's done, then it's a matter of looking at what cataloging what rules and statutes would be affected, and eventually coming up with bill language that would come to you. So that suggests the timeline. There have been these leadership planning team meetings this fall. Core group meetings are beginning. There is a plan for some stakeholder engagement in the summer and fall with the intent of having a legislative initiative for next year. I might turn my attention now to the Integrated Community Assistance Project. And again, this is the recommendation as it was shown in the MEI report. And I'm not going to read through it, but more explain it. I did want to read an alternative recommendation that this actually came from Barb Huberty, who was mentioned for the City of Rochester, who was on the work group through the MEI process. And she says, pragmatic assistance from state agencies that will help, not hinder, the local units of government that implement the laws and permit programs that they administer. Again, this is that horrible-looking graphic that Mr. Nargang referred to and Ms. Franklin referred to, with all these lines of various statutes and mandates that come to local governments for good reason, but that in the process of delivering the mandates and delivering guidance and information to local governments, sometimes it's overwhelming for local governments. That's what we were hearing through the MEI process. And it can be confusing, especially if messages and information differ from agency to agency. Again, the devil's in the details. If we do a better job at integrating these functions among state government and hopefully federal government as well, what really does that look like? What are the specific needs of local government? We need to study that a little bit better. And how do we accomplish this change? I think you've heard today that change may be needed, but change is often difficult. How do we change the work that's done by local governments, and especially how do we change that in a day of limited resources where we really can't afford to just add on new programs? So that suggests a process of better defining what integrated community assistance really means, and I looking to models that exist, such as the Community Conservation Assistance Program that Ms. Pfeiffer has been instrumental in. And I forgot to mention, Ms. Pfeiffer is also here today in the room. How do we need to assess needs at the local level, determine how we get this done among the various agencies, and assess the resources that we may need. And hopefully, as Mr. Nargang said, hopefully we can accomplish all this within existing resources. The timeline is a little less definite because the definition of what integrated community assistance is really needs to be refined. Hopefully by next February, there will be a good working definition of ICA and a couple, two or three indicators of success. And by May, have the needs analyzed and have next steps outlined. Perhaps a pilot project would be a way to proceed on integrated community assistance. Again, we're hoping to have this completed by 2011. That's what we're doing. We're very excited about these projects because we really see that they can have some great benefits, and we see that there's a way to get this job done. So thanks very much for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Kielash.
My question is on these planning alignment of planning requirements. How many levels of government are we looking at in this? We control or have the state interests at heart, but we also have counties and municipalities, and I'm not sure how many are there, so.
Well, thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair, and Senator. We have three levels of government, and a lot of at the local level, obviously, there are overlapping jurisdictions at the local level. So that's one of the things that makes this complex. We have as far as agencies, depends on the issue. If you're talking about conservation, wildlife issues, those types of things, it's probably going to reside mostly with the DNR and soil and water conservation districts, local units, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Water issues will go across the board somewhat with state agencies and pollution control agency being a primary agency for water and soil resources. You've got the Corps involved, EPA. So it depends on the issue, what agencies are involved and what levels.
The other question is, are these, each one of these, duplicating a lot of information that, if done at the same time, would all be current, or is that?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's really unclear. I mean, I think one of the challenges is that we need to document and catalog what information is being provided, the consistency of that information. As we talked about a little earlier in terms of the vision, there are different missions and visions coming from the different agencies for whatever reasons, often good reasons. And so the focus of different agencies are going to reflect different constituencies and different missions. And so the messages may be different, not by incompetence, but by true differences of purpose.
I'm hearing that the work you're doing is extremely critical to what we're interested in this process of these hearings. So I'm wondering if it would be important for us to continue, for us to interface with your work as we move along particularly in the coming months, but even beyond that. Would you be willing to, even if it is repetitive, explain what you're doing at another hearing?
Mr. Chair, we're all learning in this process, and we'd be grateful for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate this. It's very enlightening. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Next is the Citizens League Water Policy Study Committee. Mr. DeBoer, Ms. Creason, and Ms. Levinson-Falk. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Bob DeBoer, Director of Policy Development for the Citizens League.
Mr. DeBoer, would you mind moving your microphone closer to you so we can pick that up? Thank you.
I should have known. And I'm the Director of Policy Development for the Citizens League. Bob DeBoer is my name. I'm here with Diane Creason, who was co-chair with Senator Merriam for the study committee, and Annie Levinson-Falk, who's the policy manager for the Citizens League and was the lead staff on this project. Just 30 seconds on the Citizens League. We're a 57-year-old public policy nonprofit, nonpartisan. Our mission is really about identifying and proposing solutions to public policy problems, and developing the civic leaders who can work on these problems for the common good, and then really organizing the relationships to make these things happen. We operate under some civic guidelines that really direct our work in certain ways that I think you'll hear about today is a little bit different than focusing on the relationship of the state agencies. Number one, we really believe that people affected by a problem need to help define and ultimately solve a problem. Two, that all the processes that get people involved and willing to work on problems need to be transparent and need to be governed well. Otherwise, you don't get to those good solutions. Number three, that everyone who gets involved in our processes needs to understand that they're contributing their resources, bringing their connections to the table. We really try not to have passive observers in our processes. And then fourth and most important is we think if we do these other three things well, then we will be able to sustain solutions and move forward on public policy problems. I'm here just to really offer, if you have background about the Citizens League, and I'm going to hand this off to Diane Creason to give you a little background on the Water Policy Study Committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee.
Thank you. As Bob had mentioned, I had the honor of co-chairing the Citizens League Committee with former DNR Commissioner and State Senator Jean Merriam. And so I'm just going to give you a brief background on the committee and an overview of our findings before turning it over to Annie to do the tougher job of articulating our recommendations. So the committee, first of all, was intentionally formed as a very diverse group of individuals in terms of backgrounds and experience. There were people from different sectors, be that lawyers, academics, engineers, community organizers, former city council members, just to kind of name a few categories. And people also had a diverse breadth of background from people like myself that are labeled as citizen generalists that really have no formal work or responsibilities in the water area to people like Jean that are highly experienced on the other end of the spectrum. Our committee was formed in recognition that there really is no comprehensive approach to water policy in Minnesota, and hence we have a tendency to react to problems after they arise. The committee was charged to study the way that we govern water in Minnesota with a very holistic definition of governance, meaning how water is managed for the common good. Much is done by government in this area, but government is one piece of the governance system. Private businesses, nonprofits, communities, and individual citizens all have actions or inactions that have important impacts on water management And so over the course of 1 year that we studied water governance, we struggled with kind of how complex and diffuse the topic really was. So to get a kind of a more concrete handle on it, we used non-point source pollution as a case study to illuminate for us ways in which water governance must be improved. So what did we find? Well, first of all, we recognize that Minnesota waters are a hugely important resource both to our economy and to our identity in Minnesota. There's a strong public commitment to clean water, which is really a great asset that we have. This commitment was exemplified when voters passed the Clean Water Legacy and Land, Water, and Legacy Act. However, our waters do face serious threats. Fewer than 20% of the waters have been evaluated, and of those, about 40% have been found to be impaired. We've been relatively successful in addressing point source pollution in the past, but today's problems are different. The greatest pollution is now coming from non-point sources. So our governance system was set up primarily to confront point source pollution, and we have a different set of challenges, as I said today, and we need to change the way we govern to address them. So, ultimately we believe that those who contribute to water pollution need to also contribute to solutions. And we need more public participation in water management, but also a different kind of participation that Annie's going to articulate in more detail.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Annie Levinson Falcon. As Bob said, I'm the policy manager at the Citizens League, and I was the lead staff of this study. So we have three main recommendations of how to adjust our system of governing water to address the kinds of challenges that we face today. The first is that we need a collaborative model of governance that recasts the relationship between the public and government, and doing so in a way that increases public participation in water governance, and often in ways that don't currently exist. Today, the government bears the lion's share of responsibility for ensuring that our waters are clean and healthy. And we were able to address point sources of pollution like industrial wastewater or wastewater treatment plants relatively successful by regulating the few sources of pollution that were pretty easy to identify. But this system isn't working for much more diffuse non-point source pollution problems that we face today. So anything coming from agricultural runoff on urban stormwater, road salt, basically the millions of actions and decisions that are made by all of us across the state. We need to restructure the resources that we are currently using and to tap into resources that are currently being underutilized, like our citizen capacity, to be able to address this issue. With the system that we have today, it's often hard for citizens to see their roles beyond attending an occasional public meeting. And on the flip side, it places an impossible expectation on government to solve problems that can't be solved without public knowledge and effort. So we need a collaborative model that engages the public at all stages of governance, in framing issues and setting priorities, in problem-solving and developing solutions, participating in implementing those solutions, and then holding each other accountable for results. And I'll give an example of how we have done a collaborative system of government that has been done in Minnesota in just a minute. But this is very closely tied to our second recommendation, which is to design government roles and responsibilities in a way that promote this collaborative model. At the state level, this has four main pieces. Convening individuals and organizations to determine long-time priorities for water policy in the state, which is an issue that's been touched on by a few different speakers this afternoon. Assigning accountability and developing benchmarks to track progress towards those priorities. Coordinating among the various government bodies working on those priorities and encouraging collaboration where possible to achieve those common goals. And supporting local government, which is where a lot of the on-the-ground work will actually happen. So by providing data and tools for the local governments to use, and by highlighting those local governments that are doing this well and encouraging those good examples to be replicated. Where we're at today, particular tasks have been delegated from the federal to the state government and from the state to the local level without a comprehensive picture of how these all fit together. But by developing long-term goals, beginning with the values and the priorities of the individual citizens and the institutions in the state, it will make it easier for those governments bodies to be able to work together to and to coordinate their efforts towards common goals. But I want to come back to a specific example of how the state government has promoted collaborative governance in the past. This comes from what was done in the forestry industry in about a decade ago. So in the mid-90s, in a time of increasing pressures to make forestry practices more environmentally sustainable, the legislature directed the Minnesota Forest Resources Council to develop a set of best management practices for forestry. And at the Forest Resources Council, representatives from the forest industry, loggers, conservation groups, Indian tribes, federal, state, and local governments, as well as others, came together to develop this set of guidelines. These guidelines were then adopted as a criteria for two forest land certification programs and a logger certification program. And these are all voluntary programs, but most of the land owned by the state and the forest industry is certified. And Minnesota has more certified land than any other state in the country. So this model harnesses the self-interest of the individuals involved to achieve the common good. A big reason that certification is so high is that large buyers like Time Incorporated and Home Depot have insisted that most of the wood used by their suppliers be obtained from certified land. So it's in the economic interest of those people in the forestry business to certify their land and to use those practices that do, are environmentally sustainable. And in doing so, Minnesota was able to, without increasing regulation, to be able to increase environmentally sustainable practices in our forests. And this is a model that the Citizens League and other groups are currently looking into. We're very interested to see how something like this could be replicated for other industries like agriculture. Finally, our third recommendation is to create a single online water resources information hub. Data and information on our water is now collected by a lot of different groups and disseminated in a lot of different ways all around the state. But we heard from people at all levels, from an average citizen who's just looking for information about the lakes in their neighborhood, up through water policy professionals and legislators like yourselves, that it can be very difficult and that they lack enough information to make effective decisions around water policy. And part of the reason for that is that the information that we do have is just hard to find or hard to understand. So our recommendation is that the information being collected by all these diverse groups be compiled in a single place and presented in a way that's understandable and useful for an average person. So that means making it local, allowing people to find information starting geographically, if they want to, about the lakes and the rivers and the streams that they use the most or are most interested in, and answering questions that are relevant to the public, like what problems does a water body have, what are the causes and what are the consequences of those problems, and what can I do to make it better? And then it just be presented in a clear way that you shouldn't need an advanced degree or special software to be able to understand the information that's being presented. We've heard a lot of interest in this recommendation from other organizations and government agencies, so we are actually pretty optimistic that I'm being able to move that forward. So that, in a nutshell, is our report. In the next year, the Citizens League looks forward to continuing to work with our partners, including many of you in government, to advance these recommendations. Thank you, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
What was the breadth of the participation in producing this report?
Mr. Chairman, if you turn to the back of the report on page 28, you'll see a list of both members of the committee and also we received a lot of feedback and input from other people, including many of the people in the room today, that was really valuable in shaping where the report went and the outcomes. And as I said, we look forward to continuing to work with. So as Diane mentioned, it was everyone from individual citizens who don't have any formal affiliation and are interested in water because it's an important resource, to water policy engineers and to Senator Jean Merriam, or someone who has spent their entire life working on this.
What were the discussions about interfacing with the activities of the previous witnesses, the Environmental Quality Board, and the reports that they are working on?
Mr. Chairman, we actually have spoken quite a bit with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, who developed this report that's now been transferred to the EQB. And I think the area where there's the most overlap is around the shared vision. That is something that we identified independent. I mean, we did have one member who served on both committees, But in, through different processes, we both came to this as a real high priority that we need to have common priorities for where all the different pieces in the government are moving, because the system is so complex that we could be getting much higher value if we could figure out how to collaborate better with each other.
So was the has the information that the MEI project produced, as well as some of the things that the EQB is working on, has that been integrated into your report and vice versa?
Mr. Chairman, they were somewhat developed at the same time. So we had continued conversation at the staff level, as well as, I said, a common committee member. There's not exactly shared text or anything like that between our two reports, but as I said, I do think there is a lot of overlap, especially around the shared vision recommendation.
Just to add another point to that, this is Bob DeBoer, Chairman. I think also there's a difference in scope. The MEI project sticks a lot with what the agencies need to do and the government structures need to do, and I think the Citizens League is really focused on what is a different kind of model that will get citizens into this as it's our responsibility, and what are some of the different incentive structures that will get the common person into the governance of this in a more direct way.
One of the things that I think, a lot of times we kind of blame ego for legislators wanting to maintain control, and there's certainly an element of that. But I think a valid consideration is that it is legislators like those around the room who are ultimately accountable for the decisions. What discussions have you had in involving more citizens revolving around what accountability they would take on in addition to the rights and responsibilities?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a very important point. And one of the points which I didn't touch on earlier but does come through in our report is that the bottom line still does lie with the government, but that the role of the government isn't necessarily to do all of the work itself. Probably the most important role of government is to set up a system that encourages individuals to accomplish the public good by working towards their self-interest. So, for example, in what was done in the forest industry, I think, is a good example of that. So it's setting up those systems that incent businesses and other organizations and individual citizens to do the right thing because it's in their self-interest.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, there's a University of Minnesota research project out in Candy, Ohio County right now that's measuring the runoff from three sites. One is the city of Wilmer. Another is a farm field that is not fertilized with animal manure. And the third site is a field fertilized with turkey manure. Now, which of those three sites do you suppose has the biggest pollution problem?
Well, Senator Dill, an entire city would certainly have more of a problem than one field. Is that a fair comparison?
That's correct, and the difference is many-fold. In some cases, it's as much as 100-fold difference in the amount of runoff, including there's more E. coli coming off the city of Wilmer than there is off of the field fertilized with turkey manure.
Yes, but don't you need a lot of fields to compare to an entire city?
Well, I'm sure they're comparing it acre for acre.
Okay.
So the one acre of Wilmer is a lot worse than 1 acre of farmland fertilized with turkey manure. Okay. And the thing I know it's easy to pick on agriculture, and agriculture is part of the problem. I'll agree with that. But the tendency is to always pick on agriculture because everybody thinks that's such a bad problem. And on page 8, there's some talk about how agriculture is the number one cause of pollution in surveyed rivers and streams in the United States, and it seems to be true for Minnesota as well. But I think we need to remember that with biotechnology, we don't have any corn rootworm insecticide coming off hardly at all anymore because we're not using it. Because of biotechnology, the plant is producing its own insecticide. And we do have a problem with soybeans because we have to spray for aphids. It's a very bad problem, and if you don't spray for aphids at the right time, you can cut your yield in half. But now they're working on soybeans that produce their own insecticide as well. So the biotechnology is going to solve that problem eventually. And so I know it's easy to pick on agriculture, but and I know it's part of the problem, but it's so much better today than it was in the past because of conservation tillage and lots of conservation projects that are out there. And the only other point I would like to make also on page 8, under sedimentation, it's talking about erosion from stream banks, bluffs, ravines, due to changes that people have made. The point I would like to make is that stream bank erosion goes on whether, you know, even with no people around, these rivers naturally move back and forth within the floodplain, causing stream bank erosion. Now, man can make it worse because of ditching and adding extra water to the system, but a lot of these rivers started 10,000 years ago when the glaciers receded, and the Minnesota River is an example. I live on the North Fork of the Crow River, and you can clearly see in the floodplain where these rivers have moved back and forth over 10,000 years, long before man had anything to do with it. So, you know, part of this is just natural erosion that occurs, and not to say we shouldn't try to stop even the natural erosion, but to blame it all on people is not correct either. That's my editorial comment.
So we should not...
I always enjoy that.
We should not concentrate solely on agriculture, is what you're saying.
We have to look at all those human feedlots across the state.
And is that known as cities? Those are cities, don't you think? Good size
people
ones,
think,
too,
people think agriculture is bad, but it's just fine to have all this urban sprawl and put down concrete and roofs and all kinds of stuff everywhere, all over the place. I think that's wonderful economic development. But from an environmental standpoint, you're really better off with open space and ag land.
So we should not concentrate on agriculture as the only source of pollution.
All those people there, there's no reason to really have the agriculture.
Neither should agriculture be defensive about reexamining its role as well, right?
Correct.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to pursue this discussion. I do have a question about governance. When you're thinking about a template for governance of water, how we should govern water, did you take into consideration the differences of a deep water northern lake, say, for example, Vermilion, and the folks that are around that and affecting that lake, like the forestry industry, the lake owners, the tourism industry, mining, and the effect they have in water, versus let's go to the southeast Minnesota where there's a shallow meandering creek going through farm country. It's probably a trout stream, and where the folks that affected that are mostly farmers. And if you're going to affect what happens in the trout stream, you're probably going to be talking to the Department of Agriculture, Soil and Water Conservation District, Farm Bureau, and other organizations completely disparate from somebody would be interested in deep water lakes. If you've taken that into consideration and the different aspects of water across the state and the different bodies of water.
Ms. Levinson-Falk?
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I think that's a very good point, and it's probably a level of detail that we didn't get to in the report, but I think what we came down to a lot of the time is that this is so much a local issue that it is very different from place to place, not only in the types of natural resources that they're dealing with, but also in what the economic interests are, who the people are who live around there. And so we didn't want to be overly prescriptive in this report and say here's a one-size-fits-all solution to it, but that it really is going to mean working with a lot of the different folks who are involved in different places in different areas of the state.
And I would just add that's where that information hub recommendation really comes, where it can be locally used kind of information that folks on the ground can say, this is what I can do to change in my community for my water body. I think that's a real important part of this.
I just wanted to add one more point. I mean, I think that's
present.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think that's one of the strengths of our governance system is that we also have local governance involved as part of the equation, so that there is not a one-size-fits-all across the whole state, exactly to the point that you made. So it's not throwing kind of the baby out with the bathwater as we talk about a new governance moving forward, that is one strength to build upon.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, we'll hear some comments and reflections from former commissioners of the Pollution Control Agency and the DNR. Maybe all three of you could come up. Who would like to go first? I think it'd be great to hear from Mr. Merritt first. He was our first commissioner.
Because I'm the old.
You're the first. We could turn that slide machine off too, so it's not in your eyes.
I hate to contradict the chairman, but most people think I was the first. But
okay.
I actually was the second.
All right. Well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
I was there during the formative years of the PCA, 1971 to 75. And the agency was formulated by Senator Gordon Rosenmeier and then Representative John Tracy back in 1965, passed by the legislature in 1967. And for the first 29 years of the agency, we had a citizen policy-making board appointed by the governor, serving for 4 years, and sometimes they were reappointed, as was David Zentner, who spoke earlier. And that system worked so that we had a very open process. We had lots of controversy in those days, probably more than we do now, but we still have lots of controversy, and I'll get into a little bit of that in a minute. Because I was the then executive director, we had a board, and we met every month. I couldn't hold back the controversial issues, as is the tendency of most bureaucrats, especially if they're controversial, they sit on the corner of your desk. But I couldn't do that. I had to put them out on the agenda for the board to act. And I recommended to the board as the staff administrator, and the board made the decisions. And as a result, we had a lot of coverage. The agency became very well known, and we had lots of public participation, which is something I've believed in ever since I went to Duluth Central, up in Duluth. I live in the Twin Cities now. I was appointed by Governor Wendell Anderson in 71, and served for 4.5 years. And my successor, Peter Gove, and I have talked about some of the things that I'm going to mention here today, particularly in the area of water. I know you're chiefly concerned here today with water. In the area that the Citizen League report talked about particularly, and that is the maximum total daily load. But before I get into that, I want to address the questions which your administrator gave me. And that is, first of all, how the MPCA could be revitalized. Secondly, how would I have done things differently, and how could the PCA do better? Let me take the second one first, how can I do things differently? I'm sure I could have stepped on fewer toes. We had lots and lots of that going on. It's not an easy job being executive director or commissioner with a board, as Peter here knew, because he served over there as assistant when we had a policy-making board. But it certainly resulted in a lot of action. Sometimes we took a lot of heat, so probably I could have stepped on fewer toes. As far as the agency and how it could do better, I feel very strongly, as some of you on the committee, particularly Senator Anderson, knows, that we should restore the role of the board. It was changed while Mr. Larson was there, but it was his predecessor, Chuck Williams, that did it, and the governor, Arne Carlson. And the board no longer is nearly as involved in the decision-making. They really aren't a policy-making board anymore. They're more subservient to the staff and somewhat powerless. I talked to Governor Anderson, or Governor Carlson, about this not too long ago, because I know him, and I said, you know, the board was changed while you were governor, and we don't have the agency members like we used to. He said, oh, I don't like advisory boards. I said, this was not an advisory board. It was a policymaking board. Oh, is that right? Well, maybe he wasn't involved. I was at the governor's office, was involved. But Chuck Williams was involved, and it's been that way ever since 1976. I didn't know about it. I don't think that probably anybody in this room knew about it, except Peter here. But I did find out about it after I watched what the agency was doing, and I tend to, you know, I got a personal interest in it, so I follow it fairly closely. So I went over to the Supreme Court Library, and I investigated exactly, or researched exactly what went on. And I drafted a bill, which is not on the agenda this year. We didn't reintroduce it this year, but it had been introduced to restore the board. And every time we had a hearing over here in the House and the Senate, it passed out, but we haven't reached the point of passing it. And if some of you are interested, I'd be glad to get you a copy of the bill. I'd love to see it go when the time is right. This session didn't look like the right session to do it, but I haven't given up on it. And so I could go into greater detail on the board, but I think I can do that later if you have any questions. It certainly is not the open and efficient agency that we used to have. And we've had lots of problems with frogs. You've heard about that, with the mercury. And of course, you know, the agency, both the staff and the board, are only as good as the people the governor appoints. And sometimes we've had better boards than not. But when I was there, and I started with a transition from a Republican governor to a Democratic governor. And so I had a board largely appointed by Governor Levander. And despite the differences, we were able to accomplish things. And by the time we got done, we had people of the caliber of Dave Zentner sitting on that board, Marion Watson. Some of you might remember Mrs. Marion Watson. She's still around. I talked to her about this. She's about in her late 80s, and she's just as active as ever. And so we had Republicans and Democrats. We had some from industry. For example, Mary and I just talked about this not long ago. We had Mace Harris from Potlatch Paper Company up in Cloquet, vice president of Potlatch, on our board. He loved to smoke cigars. We said, well, you can't smoke cigars. You go out in the back and smoke. But by gosh, when he was reappointed by Wendell Anderson, by the way, in 1974. And one of the first things that came up after that was a vote on a Potlatch issue. And he voted against Potlatch, even though he was vice president. It can happen. It does happen. And it was really remarkable. Joe Grinnell from IDS, a lawyer, general counsel, was appointed by Wendell Anderson. And when he was up for reappointment, he had the support of the environmental community, all the environmental groups, and industry, the Mackey group that preceded Chamber of Commerce. So I served with some outstanding boards, and it was a pleasure. Even though at times, you know, you'd be up there recommending something, or your staff, your water quality director would be recommending something, and you can't control it all, so it'd be kind of a little bit emotional at times. But we did accomplish a lot, especially in the water area, but we covered radiation, radioactivity. For example, we pressed the federal government to regulate Monticello and Prairie Island. Unfortunately, by the 1954 Atomic Energy Act, we were preempted after going all the way to the Supreme Court. So we could no longer enforce the state standards on the nuclear power plants. They were adopted before I was there by John Bedalich and the previous board. As a result of that, there was a change in the federal law in 1978. When Wendell Anderson was a senator, Peter Gold worked on that when he was down in Washington. And the states now could regulate the air emissions from these reactors if they wanted to. Nobody's ever picked up on that. I think they should. But at least we weren't always preempted. But there's a lot of, as you well know, interplay between the federal government and the state government. And we got preempted on that pretty well. But we did have a serious accident up in Monticello. And I like to repeat this because constantly I read that we should have more nuclear power plants, more fission reactors. And they never mentioned the fact that there are accidents. And we had a serious one up in Monticello with 50,000 gallons of radioactivity coming down the Mississippi River to the point where the Commissioner of Health, Dr. Warren Lawson, who always would come into our agency and say there's more radioactivity coming out of this watch or the bricks in this building over here at the PCA than there is out of that nuclear reactor. He shut the water intake to the Minneapolis water supply. As a result of that, that went on the Walter Cronkite News that night. It was a serious accident in the torus underneath the reactor, causing that much radiation to go down. And when that radiation authority is still there.
What year was that, Mr. Merritt?
1973.
Okay, thank you.
And that you know, the PCA still has that authority, although they don't do anything with it. We also, the legislature, along with our recommendations, authorized us to set up a noise a branch, noise pollution administration. I hired a fellow that was expert in noise. We developed noise standards. Now, those are still there and are being enforced largely by local government, which is good. And we got into source reduction. One of the areas that I think we could have done more on, that we tried hard to get people to try to do something about the beginning of the solid waste stream. For example, all the plastics that we had. We had fewer plastic back then. We developed plastic regulations. But unfortunately, we got beat by the industry, and they never went into effect. But that's something that you might think about, because we've got an awful lot of plastic. You go in to buy milk now, you can't get milk in a carton, a paper carton anymore. That was something that maybe we could have done more on. And we could have had, I think, tougher standards on sanitary landfills. You know, when I started there in 71 and I flew around the state in DNR planes, there were 1,100 open burning dumps. Most of you are too young to remember that, but you'd fly around, you'd think of a bunch of, I shouldn't say, Native Americans were camping around the state. I mean, literally, smoke coming up all over. So we went to work and we closed down those open burning dumps, which also were full of rodents and varmints, you know. And we put in sanitary landfills. We thought, boy, that's a big improvement. Well, it was an improvement. It is an improvement. But I think we could have had better standards. We did try, but we didn't succeed in getting enough room between the bottom of the landfill and the groundwater, or enough liners. And now that's been improved over the ensuing 30 years or so. As far as how the agency could be revitalized, I think the best thing is to look at the structure. And I notice in the report of the governor's commission that Dave Zentner wrote about, there is talk about three levels of citizens' activity in government, and that would cover the PCA. I don't know that we need another layer of government. I heard about that in this hearing room today, but I do think it's important that we restore the policy-making authority, because we get people on there that are interested, they really study the issues and do a good job. Then the other thing I'd like to specifically address, and it's in the Citizens League report, and that is the MTDL matter. Page 26 of the Citizens League report, a very important appendix, in my opinion. It talks about MTDL. Now, that is a requirement, as I understand it, and I never researched this, but I'm told that that's a federal requirement by the EPA. So the PCA is out here figuring out what waters are impaired. You heard about that, 18% or whatever, and then 40%. And then they have to do this total daily maximum load or total maximum daily load. I don't understand that. I do not understand that. Because what they're doing is they're looking at water quality standards, or the water quality standard in that water, instead of the effluent standards of the pollutants, whether they're an industry or whatever. It seems to me if they looked at the effluent standards and figured out if they would meet the non-degradation rule that we put in when I was back there, we'd be far better off and we could do a much better job of cleaning up the waters. And what really concerns me is that these TMDLs cost money. And you know where it's going to come from? The legacy money. And I'm afraid in 25 years we're going to be back here saying, where'd that money go? Well, it went to consultants and engineers. And you know, you have to study, but I am seriously concerned that too much of the money is going to go to consultants, and we're not going to really clean up the water in 25 years. And if you look at this appendix, it jumps out at you because it's one study after another. First, there's a study on impaired waters. Then there's a study on the TMDL. And then that must be approved by the EPA. And then you have to have an implementation plan. And then it turns out, you know, that they might have only dealt with a single pollutant in the second to last paragraph. That's a lot of studies, one after another. And that takes time. And if you look at the very last sentence here, I'll read the whole paragraph, it's very short. To date, 29 impairments have been removed from Minnesota's impaired waters list, 20 due to remonitoring and subsequent recategorization. That sounds like something a lawyer would pull. And then nine because of activities to clean the water body after a TMLD study. I think the state of Minnesota needs to look at this. And if it's a problem by the federal government foisted on Minnesota, then let's do something about that. That's really all I have to say. I'd love to answer questions. I did want one further thing. Just to show you what's going on over at the BCA, since the board lost its power, they cancel the board meetings regularly. Here's one from 07. I get these. Here's one from 08, and here's one November of this year. The last month was canceled. They canceled the board meeting. And these aren't the only ones over those 3 years. So I think you need to look at that. And again, if you are interested in my bill, I would love to come over here and help pass it.
Thank you. Senator Frederickson.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mayor.
Yes.
Your bill about restoring the citizen board to what it was before the early 1990s. I would suggest that this coming year would be a good year to do that because there's going to be a new governor, so the current commissioner's term will end, and that would be a good time to talk about making the change. As I recall, we had quite a spirited discussion about making that change some dozen years ago or so, whenever it was. So I would respectfully suggest that this would be a good year for you to renew that discussion.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Frederickson, I appreciate your comment on that because of your experience. You've been involved in this for a good long time. I think back even to, not as far back as when I was here, 35 years ago.
Not that long.
Lovely. Thank you for your testimony. Who wants to go next? You can stay there.
Let's sit over here.
Mr. Mayor, you can stay there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Larson. I'm an attorney at Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I want to thank you for letting me go after Mr. Merritt. I've spent some time sitting in a chair much like yours with a microphone in front of me running a committee wondering what Mr. Merritt was going to say when he came up about the job I was doing. So, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My comments are going to be a little bit different than what you heard from the Citizens League and MEI, more related to the Pollution Control Agency. So I'll give you a little bit of my perspective on regulatory reform and reorganization. I was at the PCA for about 6.5 years, the last 2.5 as commissioner and chair of the board. we did quite a bit of stuff with you, actually, at that time, working on reorganizing how the PCA and some of its related entities worked. With the legislature, there was an Office of Waste Management that existed. When I was at the agency, we went through a process of changing their name to the Environmental Office of Environmental Assistance. We changed the appointment of the director of that office from a gubernatorial appointee to a commissioner appointee. And I think just recently now they finally became completely integrated into the PCA. That was an interesting process. I think we got about 60 county commissions that sent us resolutions opposing that change. And we were required to work through it with you. Senator Merriam was very involved. We changed the PCA board in a couple different ways. One was intended really to be a change to allow the public a better understanding of how the board worked. We wrote into law, and you can find it now in the law, the responsibilities of the board as it relates to permitting and environmental review, things like that. And the reason we did that was we took informal procedures that I had in my office and a few other people in the agency had in their office that were contained in three ring binders that were called delegations. And they were what told the commissioner what his or her responsibilities were versus the board. That was a frustrating process for a lot of people. I sat down one night, wrote some legislation to put that in statute, and the legislature passed it. I thought that was a good step for the public to understand how the board operated, and we did change the chair of the board. When I got to the agency, the chair of the board was a citizen member of the board. The commissioner or his or her deputy sat as a staff person next to the commissioner during the board meetings. We thought it was time, having 800 employees and a couple $100 million budget, that the commissioner, who ran the agency full time and had a lot of responsibility reporting to the governor, reporting to the legislature, actually had a seat on the board. And you might remember, if you were here, that one of the proposals was to get rid of the board. That wasn't something that we pursued with the legislature. And the agreement that we came to was, rather than getting rid of the board, we wanted to have the PCA commissioner be the chair of the board. That's existed up till now. I think that's the subject of your legislation, isn't that correct? I'd be happy to talk with you more about why I think that's a good idea. But I certainly would say that I've got a load of clients in my legal practice who would tell you that the PCA board is alive and well and influences projects every year. A couple other things we did is we moved from, this might be a little bit consistent with what you're talking about in water. We had air quality. Our divisions at the agency were air quality, water quality, hazardous waste, groundwater, solid waste, and administrative services. We had a major enforcement action when I was there. Ended up being a multi-million dollar fine. We had to bring all the agency people in who were working with that facility. I looked around the room. We had 23 staff people who needed to be in the room so we could really talk about this very large facility. And that was an indicator to me, and I think a lot of people, that we should rather have what they have now as a major facilities type of organization, where you had someone who was in charge of the water, air, hazardous waste, groundwater activities for that facility. So I think that's been a great change. We also worked, and I was proud to work with Deputy Commissioner then Nargang, on working in a cluster with other environmental agencies. And my message here is, you might talk a lot about formal changes, statutory changes, organizational changes, but nothing beats expecting agencies to work together and sit down with their budgets and figure out what their plans need to be. Because one of the lessons that I have, and I wrote down a few here, is that government reorganization is very hard to do. For everything that you have in statute, somebody asked the legislator to put it in, and there was a legislator that passed it, and if you're going to change it, those people are going to show up. I had a saying when I left, and it seemed kind of bitter, but I said I had two groups of people when I left the agency that I remembered. They were the enemies, and they were the ingrates. The enemies were the people that you changed things that they didn't like, and the ingrates were the people who would say, well, of course you did that. You were supposed to. That's your job. So you're not going to have a lot of people coming in and looking at something that's been in law for a while and saying to you, you know, we're here because you should change that. It'll be far outnumbered by the people who come in and say, this is why that's in law. We want it in there. Prove to us that you should change it. So that's one of my lessons, is government reorganization is hard to do. Second, reorganization or reform is disruptive to agency productivity. You have to understand that as you're changing things, you have to appreciate the strong culture that's that is reflected in some of our laws and the history. And I just say that's a cautionary tale for you as you move through this, that productivity declines, maybe to the point in the future of having great increases in productivity, but you should have a great appreciation for how disruptive it is when you're changing agencies around. I already mentioned that negative comments will far outweigh positive comments if you're trying to make significant change. Informal reorganization is a lot easier than formal reorganization to the extent you can work with people and help them get their jobs done without having change structures or statutes. That's a lesson that I learned. But on the other hand, structures in law and structures in agencies are very powerful, and it's a great way to drive results if you have a result that you want to drive. But I would caution you to make sure that you're focused well on a goal. I'm going to have a little bit of heresy maybe in front of the legislators here, but one of my principles might be as you move forward is be sensitive to letting commissioners run their agencies. That's a little contrary to what might be discussed before you sometimes when there are specifics, but policy discussions are important to have with lots of people, but it's very hard to run an agency. And if you have commissioners who are always worried about someone coming up and sneaking up and criticizing them for some big decision they made, what you're going to get is agency people who won't make big decisions. So have some respect as you go forward for the difficult job that commissioners have. I'll just skip to the two final ones. One is you'll note if you look at agency missions how much agency missions have moved from agencies doing things to agencies helping other people do things. I think Ron and I were probably there as a bunch of that was starting, and you'll see it now too. And that makes it very hard to run an agency. It's a much different job than what it used to be. In my world, more in the environmental protection area, I'm amazed even in the last few years how much more influential EPA is from their Chicago office, how much more influential the tribes have been as they've staffed up, how influential the National Forest Service, National Park Service, those types of people on visibility are. So missions are evolving, and the importance of cooperation, I think, has become paramount, and the barriers to actually getting something done are higher now because there are so many people involved. And finally, I just want to commend this group to the extent you can clear the way a little bit from some of this planning paralysis. I just have an example of a client who was in a municipality, had several permits that they needed, including wetlands permits. And we were told that the planning people in this municipality could only take one. It was a multi-project, many pieces of a bigger project. They could only take one of our projects per month because they were so busy with planning that they could only spend so much time dealing with actual projects. And I didn't disagree. We had no complaint. They had responsibilities that they had to fulfill. And so we had to live with that. But I would say, as much as anything, to the extent you can help those government folks out there get to the point of working with projects and trying to get stuff done and doing their planning in an efficient way, and so it's done well, but freeing up agency folks to actually and government folks to actually do what they'd probably like to do is work on projects and get things done, I think that would be a valid goal.
We have at some point we'll have Chamber of Commerce testify. Maybe we'll ask them how a business balances the importance of constantly updating its business plan with actually implementing the plan. It's important to have both, but it's a common theme we seem to be hearing that there's a planning and report paralysis. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Larson? Thank you very much. Mr. Nargang.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Ron Nargang, and for the purposes of this discussion, I'm a citizen. I left my MEI hat over there on the chair, so don't construe anything I have to say as representing MEI policy. And I'm going to try to stay pretty much with the questions that staff provided. And the first one of those was aimed at whether the missions become stagnant in agencies, and I'll try to relate to it from the DNR perspective because that's what I know. In my take on this is it's not so much a stagnant mission, is that the challenges that we face have changed so dramatically. And I'm going to use an example that you've all been faced with very recently out of the arena of forest management. 25 years ago, no one would have conceived that domestically owned paper companies in the state of Minnesota would liquidate their land asset because it was their lifeblood. It provided timber that would flow through their mills, whether they were making paper or lumber. And suddenly, we find ourselves in a situation where we not only don't have a domestically owned timber company in the state anymore, but they are owned by international companies that have a totally different business model and view that land asset as an underperforming asset and want to sell it off. That changed the whole game for forest managers in this state because those large blocks of commercial forest land are embedded right in there with public lands. And so what happened? But you ended up with a proposal put in front of you to do something about the fragmentation of those large blocks of interior forest. That is a radical change and challenge that I think, frankly, Minnesota responded very favorably to in the actions you took to secure easements to protect those large blocks. And you got more of that coming, I know. But I think that's just one classic example of how our global economy has changed the game that we're all in trying to deal with resource challenges. Has government kept up with all of that? Probably not. And we'll probably always play some catch-up with that. But keep an eye to that and not just condemning the institutions as you begin to look at that. And there was a rather pointed question here about whether the institutions are more important than the mission. And there may be folks that would react differently to this, but I cannot say that I encountered that in the Minnesota DNR. What I encountered there is a workforce that is single-mindedly dedicated to the best outcome for the resource. You can agree or disagree with their approaches to getting there, but most of the folks in that agency are doing what they're doing because it's exactly what they wanted to do all their lives, and it's about the best outcome for the resource. I may be a little jaundiced in that I had the privilege of working for a commissioner who used to end staff meetings by looking around a room and saying, now have we done the right thing for the resource? And I just think that coming from the leader of the agency can indicate for you the kind of commitment that you have in those people to doing the right thing for the resource. You also asked if, in retrospect, there's anything I would have done differently. And I thought quite a bit about this, and things popped into my mind about falling 5 votes short in the House on the Mille Lacs Treaty and things like that. But really the thing that I came back to that I would have done differently is I'd have spent a lot more time thinking about succession planning in the agency. In the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to have a profound change in how these agencies are led. Because all of us dinosaurs that got hired in the 1970s when the environmental revolution occurred in this country are retiring, just like I did. And it's going to open up a tremendous number of slots to be filled in these agencies that are ultimately going to determine the change in direction that they take in managing resources and working with each other and working across agency boundaries. And I wish I'd have spent a little more time thinking about the implications of that when I was in a leadership role in the agency, because it's really an opportunity to revolutionize the thinking. Just an example that I saw change when I was in the system is that foresters and wildlife managers used to be taught in our educations of higher learning that they shouldn't get along. You know, their missions were at cross purposes. And while I was in the DNR, you could see that change because the new people coming out of college were trained differently, and they realized that good forest management didn't have to be inconsistent with good wildlife management. It's that kind of fundamental change in thinking that can occur over a really very short period of time and can help break down that barrier that Peter enunciated so well of the difficulty in changing the way agencies work. They'll change because there's going to be different people sitting there. And then there's that open question, are there things we could do better? I've sat here already today and talked to you about interagency coordination, and I would be remiss in not coming back to that. We clearly need better coordination across agencies, but I couldn't agree more with what Peter said, that so much of it should happen organically, that it shouldn't have to be mandated. I spent almost 5 years as the director of waters in DNR, and we had monthly meetings of the water directors among state agencies. As near as I can tell, that doesn't happen anymore. There was no legislative mandate that had to happen. Hell, I did it for survival purposes. I wanted to know what was hanging out there that might jump up and bite me next Monday. And so we got together on a regular basis to talk about those kinds of things. The other big limitation that I see you facing, and I suspect you're fighting it as individuals, is budget cutting fatigue. I left state government in 99. We'd been cutting budgets for 4 or 5 years then, and it's been year after year after year since I left government. That all lands in your laps. It all lands in those state agencies' laps, too. And you talk to people in the organizations, and you can feel the fatigue in them. They just hate to think about opening the door the next morning because that's what they're going to deal with, is less resources, how to cut those resources, less people, how to cover for the people that are gone. That's a tough climate to make change in, but it's probably one of the most important climates to make change in, but be aware of it. I also want to suggest to you that you need to look at things you could do better. As I wander around talking to people about different topics, one of the things that comes up repeatedly is the loss of legislative commissions, like the Legislative Commission on Water, the Legislative Commission on Solid Waste. Those may have been viewed during times of tight budgets as luxuries for you, but when they went away, you lost the opportunity to have a focal point in the legislature to provide consistent interaction with the agencies responsible for those topics. And more importantly, I think you lost the opportunity to have specialists in your legislative bodies, people who knew intimately the details. And my God, all you got to do is start peeling away the layers on water, and you're going to find out how complicated that one is. You really had an asset in a group of people, House and Senate members, that knew that issue intimately and that other members could go to for guidance and counsel on issues that were before your bodies for decision-making. So as you're looking at this, think about the loss of some of those things as well. A couple of final comments. If you're going to go into a reform discussion looking for a silver bullet, I don't think it exists. I've worked with an awful lot of other states with different structures, and I'm convinced that there is no magic structure to use for this. And my experience has always been it's more about people. It's people that make these things work. And it almost doesn't matter the structure you impose on them. If you have the right people with the right commitment to make the system work, it can work. Take a look at the history of the Michigan DNR, going from single agencies to super agency back to single agencies. I watched that. I sat on the Interstate Conference on Water Policy while that was going on. Michigan was there, and it was changes in people that dictated that. It wasn't that one system was better than the other or worse than the other. Finally, my good friend Dave Zentner left here, and I hate to disagree with him, but I've never been a fan of citizens' commissions. And I understand the arguments for them, and I've worked with boards both in the government sector and the old Salt and Water Conservation Board, and when I left state government with the Nature Conservancy, And I would just suggest to you that as you're thinking about the use of a citizen's governing body of any type, consider two factors pretty carefully. The first one is efficiency. When you need to get decisions made, going to a citizen's commission is not necessarily the most efficient way to get that decision made and can get pushed off from one monthly meeting to another. And secondly is accountability. Under the system you've got now, you know who's accountable for the decisions. You can go to the person occupying the corner office of this building and put the finger on the commissioner that makes those decisions. If you put a commission between them and yourselves, I think you lose accountability. That's the end of my comments.
Yeah, I was going to recommend a citizen board for the DNR.
Questions for Mr. Nargang.
Go ahead.
Senator Fredrickson. Well,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nargang, I just want to concur with what you said about the loss of the Solid Waste Commission and the Water Commission. We lost a lot when they were eliminated, both the legislators who were kind of experts in those fields, but also some very skilled and knowledgeable staff that just worked on those issues. You know, a number of times I went to the Solid Waste Commission, the staff at the Solid Waste Commission, to get information about an issue or policy. And we should never have eliminated those. We had to fight to keep hard to keep the LCMR.
I understand.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really
appreciate
it.
Thank you for your time.
I want to make sure that the public has a chance to comment. This is a very important part of our hearing. It's important that everyday people who have experienced our natural resource programming have an opportunity to share experiences, kick us in the teeth a little if they desire, and perhaps offer suggestions on improvement. So at this time, if there are people who would like to comment not only on what we've heard today, but in general, you're invited to approach the table. Very good. Well, thank you very much for attending this meeting. This is the first of a series. I believe our next one will be on January 15th, if we do not call one beforehand. It will be in the city of Bemidji. The Senate has approved this for our travel and expense purposes, and look for more details from my committee staff on where we will stay and travel arrangements, et cetera. But it should be a very good meeting. It's a great opportunity to take this discussion out to greater Minnesota, out to the people. Thank you very much, and if there are no further comments, the committee is adjourned.